from the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Soundings now presents part one in a series of discussions about literary biography. The topic of the conversation at hand is George Gordon, Lord Byron, the English aristocrat and poet who lived from 1788 till 1824. My guest is Jerome J. McGann, professor of humanities at the California Institute of Technology. Professor McGann has edited the poetry of Lord Byron and has written books and articles about Byron, including Fiery Dust, Byron's Poetic Development. I asked Professor McGann to begin with a description in general terms of the shape of Byron's life.
It's heterogeneous. He was, the main frame, as it were, of his life is very clear and indeed very interesting. He was born just before the French Revolution. He began to write poetry right in the middle of the Napoleonic campaigns. And just before the most important of those, the Peninsula Campaign. The Peninsula Campaign begins in 1809. He becomes famous in 1812, which is even more famous perhaps was in the case of somebody else, Napoleon. He leaves England shortly after Napoleon is forced to abdicate. His main years as a writer are in exile. More or less the same years that Napoleon is in exile. And it's against the background, really, of those reactionary years of the Restoration that his greatest work is produced. I would definitely say that the main outlines of his career are shaped, as almost everybody else who was an artist at that time, by the phenomenon of the Revolution and the aftermath.
What kinds of things did he write? What kinds of things is he noteworthy for?
He wanted to be great.
He wanted to be famous.
More than that, he wanted to be great.
Uh-huh.
He wanted to be Alexander. He wanted to be a great human being, not a great artist or something like that. Keats, for a person like Keats, the highest goal in his imagination is to be a great poet. Byron frequently in his life heaps contempt upon this idea.
Mm-hmm.
What he really wants to be is somebody like Alexander or Napoleon. Partly, when you ask that question, I think of his initial fascination with Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed it was lifelong. He died in Greece, fighting for Greek independence against the Turkish Empire. It was first, certainly in my view, his first, maybe his best idea of himself. As a kind of Themistocles or something like that. His aristocratic heritage, this would certainly be a background against which one would not conceive of oneself as a writer, but as a man of affairs, a man of the world.
In that regard, would you say that all of his poetry is political? Is that what's right there at the core of his desire to be great? You mentioned this term, a man of affairs.
Yes. I would say yes, almost all of it. One might accept a few important things like Manfred, although they exist in the orbit of his political passions. He's the most, of all the writers of this period, he's the most topical.
Mm-hmm.
All of his works invest themselves in the events and affairs of the day. Much of Byron's charm, by the way, is, at least in my opinion, the deliberate anachronism of his life. He grows attached to things that are passing. And he has a what I have always felt to be a very admirable commitment to lost things or causes or situations, whatever, habits, manners, and so forth, which are no longer popular or acceptable.
How did all of this manifest itself in his writing? Give me a for instance.
Well, the tales.
Mm-hmm.
They look like adventure tales, swashbuckling things. They seem to me to be obvious political allegories that come out of this class situation and the conflicts of a person, an aristocrat in this case,
who is suffering either the privilege or the doom of historical backwardness.
He became famous for a series, well, first for the first two cantos of Childe Harold, which are very political. The focus of those early cantos is the Peninsular War and what he saw as the cynical investment of French and English affairs in a quest for empire, essentially, economic empire. They are very, very cynical and despairing poems. After that, he wrote a series of tales, beginning with a tale called The Giaour, and they're all about these displaced aristocrats who make war on ordinary and conventional society in one way or another. They're never English society, so that the whole question of politics is displaced into Oriental and exotic settings. But despite the displacement, it's very obvious that these are disguised stories about the condition of politics in England as seen from the point of view of an aristocrat who regards his power over affairs as nil or without effect. So they're shot through with cynicism and despair. This dominates really all of his poetry, but when he leaves England in 1816 and takes up his life in exile, the character of his political work in poetry changes. He begins to associate himself with Italian revolutionary movements, and as everybody knows, I suppose, who knows anything about Byron's life, in the end, he leaves Italy and what he sees or judges to be an impossible political state of affairs there in relation to a hopeful revolution, and goes to fight in the Greek revolutionary cause, where he dies. So his life becomes more and more political. His poetry also does, and although it always retains a streak, a deep streak of cynicism and despair, in the end, in my opinion, the poetry's power as political poetry, engagé poetry, is deeply tied to its despair. It's the reflex of a gesture toward a utopia, which he sees to be or feels to be impossible, at least at the present time. Byron is, one of his great virtues is he knew how to hate, and he prided himself in this, in fact. And so there's a, his letters, all his work has a streak of an edge to it, even a maliciousness. When he has an enemy, there is no quarter. Don Juan, you mentioned before, very political poem. It began, as so much of Byron's work began, in personal pique.
Who was he mad at?
He was mad at Wordsworth and he was mad at Southey. And a friend of his, or at least part-time friend, or in some way a friend, Leigh Hunt, had the misfortune to tell him in June of 1818 that he thought that Wordsworth was at the top of his profession in poetry. Byron was appalled by this idea, and 2 weeks later he's writing the initial stanzas of his masterpiece Don Juan, which is an ad hominem attack of the most malicious sort on Wordsworth, Southey, and their circle.
What was he mad at? What specifically upset him? What in Wordsworth?
At that particular time, politics. The early years of the Restoration. His ambiguous hero, Napoleon, had been destroyed. Wordsworth and Coleridge and Southey are the most important ideological mouthpieces for England's position in the world at that time. Therefore, they become the objects of his attack at the level of ideology, because that's where it's all at when you're talking about poets fighting with poets. Listen to just four lines from Don Juan. This is from toward the end of the first canto. The topic is, once again, Wordsworth, Coleridge, and Southey, and their pretense to set up what he called new poetic rules.
And so he decides, well, if they can set up new poetic rules, anybody can set up poetic rules, and I'll give you my poetic rules. Thou shalt believe in Milton, Dryden, Pope. Thou shalt not set up Wordsworth, Coleridge, Southey, because the first is crazed beyond all hope, the second drunk, the third so quaint and mouthy. With Crabbe it may be difficult to cope, and Campbell's Hippocrene is somewhat drouthy. Thou shalt not steal from Samuel Rogers, nor commit flirtation with the muse of Moore. And then at the end, there's a very witty turn at the end of the first canto. It goes in this fashion. Go, little book, from this my solitude. I cast thee on the waters, go thy ways. And if, as I believe, thy vein be good, the world will find thee after many days. When Southey's read and Wordsworth's understood, I can't help putting in my claim to praise. The first four rhymes are Southey's every line. For God's sake, reader, don't take them for mine. He was the most famous poet of his day, and I believe the reason was that the various contradictions in his society at that time are most completely manifested in Byron. Mm-hmm. They may be more intensely, it's a moot point, manifested, say, in Keats or Wordsworth or Coleridge, but nowhere near as completely in a social sense. It's all there. He also liked to covet the idea or the myth of himself as the man of affairs in all senses, so that he would say that he wrote The Corsair standing on one foot with a hangover while he was shaving in the morning after a long night. and this image of himself as a poet was very dear to him.
You can talk about women and sex in Byron's life on a personal level. You can talk about it in terms of his poetry. Are they just totally interchangeable?
They are not interchangeable, but they are inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
It is not possible to read Byron's poetry, in my opinion, without being invested in a heavy way in an understanding of his life. Now, Byron is so egomaniacal, if you will, as a poet, that he puts his own life deliberately into the poetry, so that if you never read a biography of Byron or his incomparable letters, but just read the verse, you would get to know a great deal about Byron, because he is one of his, if not his most favorite subject. So the data from his actual life is there.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. My guest is Jerome J. McGann, Professor of Humanities at the California Institute of Technology. The conversation is about George Gordon, Lord Byron, the 19th century English poet and aristocrat, who refused to write for money, and who characterized his poetry as the lava of the imagination.
Who were the women in Byron's life? I understand there were dozens, if not hundreds of them. Can you name a couple of women that figure importantly in his life, personally and poetically?
Mary Chaworth, first, mm-hmm. I would say.
Now, who is she?
Mary Chaworth was a cousin whom he fell in love with in a puppy love situation when he was at Harrow and for some years afterwards. She was married to someone else. He wanted to marry her, or at least he conceived that he wanted to marry her. And when she married somebody else, he conceived that he was thrown into the worst despair that any human being was ever thrown into, and wrote a bunch of poems about this. And indeed, the whole relationship haunted him through his life. This lost dream of the perfect beloved. After Mary Chaworth, the first person that would occur to me would be Lady Caroline Lamb. Now, she is typical of a certain kind of woman that Byron repeatedly became involved with, as Mary Chaworth was a typical of a certain kind of relationship that he often established with women. In the first case, sentimental. In the second case, fiery. The Lady Caroline was really too much for Byron, and their intense relationship came to an end when Byron realized that she was way beyond him in the capacity for extravagant behavior. And he just had no conception of how he would be able to control this passionate person. So he escaped. She scared him. At the same time, another very important person was Lady Melbourne, an older woman, and he confided in her at this time and for some years afterwards the various complicated liaisons that he was having at this particular time. And he had relationships with older women of this kind repeatedly in his life. Then, maybe more important than anyone, his sister, Augusta Lee. He said at several times that she was the single human being he most loved in his life. Scandal, of course, associates the two of them in an incestuous relationship, which is probably, in fact, true. They were half brother and half sister. He certainly was deeply attached to her. Annabella Milbank, his wife, his moral Clytemnestra, his Medea. Then there is the exile. There is an important person, Claire Claremont, whom Byron had a brief affair with and who bore his natural child. This child later died when in a convent in Italy. Then there were a series of liaisons in Italy, the most famous of which is with his amica, as he called her, the Contessa Teresa Guiccioli, which this liaison, that is to say, lasted for, well, all the years after he met her until he left for Greece. He had a number of flings and whatnot, famous ones with Margherita Cogni and Maria Segatti and other ladies and women in Italy, but Teresa is the most important one. And those really are the key women in his life. He knows women very well, and he has some great passages about women and women's minds as seen from a man who has spent a great deal of time with them, and sympathetic time as well as perhaps oppressive or lordly time.
Would Gloria Steinem, for instance, call him a chauvinist?
Certainly.
Or worse?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly conceived women made for love. Byron is famous as a lover.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he lived a life in love. And his last really great poem is on this subject. It's a little lyric called On This Day I Complete My 36th Year, written just a few months before he died. And the subject of this poem is love and heroism, the two obsessions of his life, to be great, a hero, and to be in love, to be attached to what your desiring imagination most needs and demands. The poem is a poem of despair in that he realizes he's been crucified in the vain quest for each of these figmentary ideals. And it becomes literally a suicide poem. Specifically, however, the poem repudiates love as a way of life, the initial crucifixion. But it also recognizes the absurdity of the heroism here properly and traditionally marshaled, imaged as a martial life, which he manifestly sees in this poem as self-contradictory. And so the triumph of the poem is to turn the pursuit of martial glory into a pursuit of his own death. Typical Byron.
What do people need to know about Byron? What is there about him that you think about?
Living. Surely more than anything else, if you read his poetry or his wonderful letters or a life of him or something like that, you are most struck initially by a person who lived a tremendously intense and full life. And you can't but be impressed by that, especially perhaps in our own day when we're so surrounded by a world in which intensity of living seems continually circumscribed by apparatuses, systems, and so forth that eviscerate perhaps at least one sense of one's own intensity. Byron burned through 36 years, and there wasn't much left of him when it was over, except the intensity of what he had lived through. I find that incredibly impressive.
Give me a couple of examples from Byron's letters that illustrate the kind of man that he was, the kind of life that he lived, and his style, literary and personal.
He's very famous for his letters. They've just been edited again in a, for the first time, completely unexpurgated edition by the great, probably the greatest Byron scholar who has ever lived, Leslie Marchand. And these letters are just a wonder and a delight to read. Let me take, for example, a passage from a letter that he writes to his publisher, John Murray, in the middle of 1819. This letter comes at a time when there is fierce discussion over his new poem, Don Juan. His friends know how wonderful it is, but they're also horrified by it. And so they're trying to get him to tone it down, to alter it, to in some way modify it so it becomes less outrageous. And this is what Byron says. "But to return to your letter of the 23rd of July, you are right, Gifford is right, Crabb is right, Hobhouse is right, you are all right, and I am all wrong, but do pray, let me have that pleasure. Cut me up root and branch, quarter me in the quarterly, send round my disjecti membra poetae, like those of the Levite's concubine. Make, if you will, a spectacle to men and angels, but don't ask me to alter, for I can't. I am obstinate and lazy, and there's the truth. But nevertheless, I will answer your friend C.V., that's Francis Palgrave, who objects to the quick succession of fun and gravity, as if in that case the gravity did not, in intention at least, heighten the fun. His metaphor is that we are never scorched and drenched at the same time. Blessings on his experience. Ask him these questions about scorching and drenching. Did he never play at cricket or walk a mile in hot weather? Did he never spill a dish of tea over his testicles in handing the cup to his charmer, to the great shame of his Nanking breeches? Did he never swim in the sea at noonday with the sun in his eyes and on his head, which all the foam of the ocean could not cool? Did he never draw his foot out of a tub of too hot water, damming his eyes and his valets? Did he never inject for a gonorrhea, or make water through an ulcerated urethra? Was he ever in a Turkish bath, that marble paradise of sherbet and sodomy? Was he ever in a cauldron of burning oil like St. John, or in the sulfurous waves of hell, where he ought to be for his scorching and drenching at the same time? Did he never tumble into a river or lake fishing, and sit in his wet clothes in the boat, or on the bank afterwards, scorched and drenched like a true sportsman? Oh, for breath to utter! But make him my compliments, he is a very clever fellow for all that."
What he's talking about is complexity. People who don't want to avoid the complexities of life and the contradictions and all the little annoyances and pains. Is that it?
Yes. His letters are brilliant because they swerve and veer, take in a great deal. There's a famous maxim he laid down for all travelers. You should see everything once with attention. When you read his letters, you know that you're in the presence of a person who is intensely engaged with what is around him. He sees and connects in very complicated and various ways. So his letters are wonderful. They reflect that variety and complexity that you mentioned. It's not really possible to leave Byron's letters without perhaps glancing at one famous letter, or one of a number of famous letters, in which he describes one of his amorous relations. This one is a passage I'm going to quote from, excerpt from, really. Very long letter in which he describes his meeting with Margarita Cogni, who was a peasant wife of a baker whom he fell into a liaison with. It lasted for some time and then it broke up. His publisher asked him to tell about Margarita Cogni in full. He wanted to know more about her, and so Byron wrote this very long letter.
When I first knew her, I was in relazione, liaison, with La Signora Segatti, who was silly enough one evening at Dolo, accompanied by some of her female friends, to threaten her, for the gossips of the villeggiatura had already found out, by the neighing of my horse one evening, that I used to ride late in the night to meet the Fornarina. Margherita Coni. Margherita threw back her veil, Faziolo, and replied in very explicit Venetian, "You are not his wife. I am not his wife. You are his donna, and I am his donna. Your husband is a cuckold, and mine is another. For the rest, what right have you to reproach me? If he prefers what is mine to what is yours, is it my fault? If you wish to secure him, tie him to your petticoat string, but do not think to speak to me without a reply, because you happen to be richer than I am." When I came to Venice for the winter, she followed. I never had any regular liaison with her, but whenever she came, I never allowed any other connection to interfere with her, and as she found herself out to be a favorite, she came pretty often. But she had inordinate self-love, and was not tolerant of other women, except of the Segatti, who was, as she said, my regular amica, so that I, being at that time somewhat promiscuous, there was great confusion, and demolition of headdresses and handkerchiefs, and sometimes my servants, in redding the fray between her and other feminine persons, received more knocks than acknowledgments for their peaceful endeavors. At last she quarreled with her husband, and one evening ran away to my house. I told her this would not do. She said she would lie in the street, but not go back to him, that he beat her, the gentle tigress, spent her money, and scandalously neglected his oven. He was a baker. As it was midnight, I let her stay, and next day there was no moving her at all. Her husband came roaring and crying, and entreating her to come back, not she. He then applied to the police, and they applied to me. I told them and her husband to take her. I did not want her. She had come, and I could not fling her out of the window, but they might conduct her through that of the door or the door if they chose it. She went before the commissary, but was obliged to return with that becco etico, consumptive cuckold, as she called the poor man who had a tisic. In a few days she ran away again. After a precious piece of work, she fixed herself in my house, really and truly without my consent, but owing to my indolence and not being able to keep my countenance, for if I began in a rage, she always finished by making me laugh with some Venetian pantaloonery or other, and the gypsy knew this well enough, as well as her other powers of persuasion, and exerted them with the usual tact and success of all she things, high and low, they are all alike for that. She was always in extremes, either crying or laughing, and so fierce when angered that she was the terror of men and women and children, for she had the strength of an Amazon with the temper of a Medea. She was a fine animal, but quite untamable.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You've been listening to a conversation about the 19th century English poet Lord Byron. My guest was Jerome J. McGann, Professor of Humanities at the California Institute of Technology. This program is the first in a series of discussions about literary biography. Subsequent conversations will focus on Alfred Lord Tennyson, Robert Louis Stevenson, William Butler Yeats, Ezra Pound, Graham Greene, and Willa Cather. Next week on Soundings, the topic will again be Lord Byron, and my guest will be Leslie Marchand, Professor Emeritus of English at Rutgers University. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for part one in a series of discussions about literary biography. Conversations that examine literary figures ranging from Lord Byron and Robert Louis Stevenson to Ezra Pound, Graham Greene, and Willa Cather. This week's program focuses on George Gordon, Lord Byron, the 19th century English aristocrat who refused to write for money and who characterized his poetry as the lava of the imagination. My guest will be Jerome J. McGann, Professor of Humanities at the California Institute of Technology, an authority on Byron and one of the editors of Byron's poetry. The Art of Literary Biography, Part 1, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.